the Russians tested our response, and they received both U.S. response in the form of F-22s and escorts, and as well as our Canadian colleagues in response. You hate to see the testing part. All countries do test. But I would argue what we've seen in the last week is a real burst of intense activity that we haven't seen since 2015, to have four exercises within a short period of time. The Pentagon, at least in its description, believes that the Russians may be testing out their new long-range bomber, and I think also wanting to go to places that they hadn't tested our response time. So I think that's probably what's been going on.
Any reason to think that there's something else provoking or prompting this string of flyouts?
I think in part we could see it could be, again, it's very difficult to get into the minds of exactly the Kremlin and Russian military leaders, but I think you could put it in context to beefing up a response since the United States launched 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles into Syria. I think you could also see it in light of U.S. aircraft carrier movement towards North Korea. Also, the Russians have responded by deploying some forces to their border with North Korea. So I think in some ways it's a bit of posturing. It's to demonstrate that, like the United States, Russia has a global military reach. They can do multiple things in multiple geographic arenas, and they are an equal, as they want to be seen, as an equal militarily to the United States.
As you mentioned, it's been a while since we've seen a concentration of these flyouts. What was going on the last time we saw kind of a string of them?
Well, 2015, I think, was the last string. Again, that could have also run in parallel with Russia's military operations in Syria. They entered Syria in September of 2015. A little earlier flights we've seen, I think, were in part in context of the annexation of Crimea and the incursion into eastern Ukraine. We certainly saw an uptick in 2014, again, Russia demonstrating its military capabilities. Again, you know, militaries do. We test in international waters and international airspace. We do the same thing. But again, I think we have to make sure we fully understand and signal back to the Russians our equal resolve in responding to these types of incursions.
There's been reporting commentary on what's been characterized as Russia's active measures, and that they're not really geared toward anything other than introducing chaos, uncertainty. Does this logic hold for military missions like these, or is there a different targeted goal?
So I would not put these incursions in sort of the active measures bucket. Active measures, again, and you can also say compromat, that's to undermine society, undermine society's confidence in its leaders and its institutions and its democracy, quite frankly. What we're seeing here is very much traditional military checking, response, resolve, readiness. And that is pretty standard fare. Yes, there is a psychological component to it. When you see an uptick in Russian military testing of U.S. response, whether that's a spy ship in the waters off of the Atlantic eastern seaboard, the Atlantic coast last summer, or these types of air incursions, enhanced military activity in the eastern Mediterranean, in the Pacific, these add up to, again, a psychological benefit of the Russian military has global reach just like the U.S. But active measures, influence operations, that kind of thing, it's completely different. But, you know, you put them together and they can have a pretty impressive impact on society.
The equivalent, the U.S. equivalent of what we've just seen with Russia, we have massive training operations in the Pacific, but how often do our military aircraft do these kinds of flyouts that kind of cruise close to the Russia airspace?
You know, I'm not entirely sure what, and the Pentagon would be best to respond to that and give you numbers. I would sense we do it from time to time. Again, you have to be careful. You're sending a signal of making sure that you have freedom of navigation and freedom of air sovereignty. that you don't want, as we're seeing the Chinese do in the South China Sea, you don't want international passages to be closed off. You want to continue to test and make sure you have those freedom of navigation operations. But you also have to be careful, again, of the signaling. In times when there are heightened geopolitical tensions, when you do these types of things, they have an outsized response. I think this is what we see in the incursions over the last week. You're seeing senior level responses from Senator McCain, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, others. You know, it does get noticed, it gets commented on, and in some ways, that is exactly what the Kremlin, I'm sure, had in mind. It wants to get our attention and to respond to its growing military power.
What's your level of concern about the risk associated through miscommunication, or what if one of the planes has trouble and goes down and somehow signals get crossed about what actually happened? How risky is it every time this happens that it could escalate into something much larger in an unintended kind of a side risk?
Well, there is always risk, particularly when our militaries are operating in very close proximity in the same theater. The concern for most Pentagon officials is how closely we are operating with the Russian military over Syria and Syrian airspace. And that's why we have tried to take a lot of important steps in deconfliction, because we don't want an accident. I would say that Russian behavior has tried to be as provocative as it can be, certainly closer to the Baltic Sea region and the Black Sea region, where Russian aircraft have come within, I believe it was 100 feet of the USS Donald Cook in the Black Sea. They have come very dangerously close to civilian aircraft that are flying over the Baltic Sea region. Again, this is very dangerous. While, yes, militaries signal to one another their abilities and what they have on display, we have to have our top safety concern, our civilians, obviously, and military personnel. And there is always a risk of you're flying that close, or you're trying to get so close to an aircraft that there is a mishap and loss of life. And, you know, what you don't want to see is an accident that escalates to potential conflict.
Heather, the 200-mile U.S. air identification zone, it's international airspace. Russians are certainly allowed to fly there. But what authority does the U.S. and the North American Aerospace Defense Command actually have over this airspace?
Well, this is international law. You have that 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone and then the 12 nautical mile territorial waters. There's a difference between the two. Again, I will say that procedures have been followed. Everyone, when you come into the air identification zone, and if they don't get the proper response, there will be a scramble. This is what we do. We have to respect international law. That's why it becomes very dangerous when any country decides that it's going to shred the rules of international law and try to test and try to create new rules. We have to respect these rules. That's how countries operate. When territory is violated, like we've seen in Ukraine, like we've seen in the South China Sea, like we've seen elsewhere, that is when the rule of law gets shredded, we go into conflict. So we have to respect these rules. The U.S. is made safer by these rules and enforcing these rules. So they are very important. And these particular four instances that happened over the last couple of days, everyone did follow the rules. And I think that needs to be underscored.
We know that Russia is militarily building up along the northern Arctic coast. What are your observations about this? Is it the right and responsible thing to do, given an increasingly open Arctic and more vessel traffic, more potential for search and rescue? Or is this something else?
Well, actually, the last couple of days, in addition to the air incursions near Alaska, we've been given a pretty visual picture of President Putin observing ice glaciers, as well as a new military outpost in the Russian Arctic. I think all of these, again, create a background that the Arctic remains very important to Russia economically as well as militarily. Russia has, I think, relearned something that we have forgotten, how strategic the Arctic is, how quickly you can have access to the North Atlantic and to the North Pacific. It's what Alaskans know so well, which is why the distant early warning line was placed in Alaska, why defending Alaska has always been so vital to U.S. Geostrategic interests. So what we're seeing Russia doing, this is part of their national narrative, that the Arctic is theirs. It is the Russian Mecca, as the Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin has said. They want to project their sovereignty, and they also are keenly interested in developing the natural resources in Russia's exclusive economic zone, the energy resources, as well as President Putin does have a very ambitious vision for turning the Northern Sea Route into a major international transit. Now, the figures and use of the Northern Sea Route certainly do not match that vision. So some of the military footprint we're seeing is about increasing search and rescue capabilities and infrastructure. We need that in the American Arctic ourselves. But there is a growing military posture to all of this, I think, which is concerning. Does it mean that we're going to see a major U.S. military buildup in the Arctic? No, we don't need to do that. But we need to have a much clearer focus. We have to understand what the Russians are trying to achieve militarily. It appears to me they're trying to deny access to the U.S. and NATO of the strategic areas in the North Pacific and the North Atlantic. That's what we have to challenge that a bit. It's not a huge military buildup, but we do have to enhance our readiness and our military posture to be prepared for anything. As this past week's incursions show us, the Russians are testing our readiness.
And having just said that, given the recent tensions with Russia, Syria, North Korea, what do you think the next decade will mean for Alaska's military?
Well, I think this is why Senators Sullivan and Murkowski and Congressman Young have been very focused in educating members of Congress about why the Arctic and Alaska have now new significance as tensions with Russia have increased. If you follow Arctic developments, you also recognize that China has a growing presence and role in the Arctic. As President Obama discovered when he visited Alaska 2 years ago, he was also met by five Chinese naval vessels that were exercising off the Aleutians. We have to understand that we will be tested. We have to be ready for those powers that want to challenge the U.S. and our military readiness. So I think we have to switch now from education, which is important, to action. And we have to start focusing and heightening budgets and to increase. I think we, Secretary Mattis was quizzed directly by Senator Sullivan in his confirmation hearing about the Arctic. Other senators, Senator Angus King of Maine, have also focused on our readiness, whether that's from icebreakers for the Coast Guard, to increasing presence, whether that's the Air Force presence in the F-22s, but also our cold weather training and our expertise in that area. We've lost a little of that expertise and that forward-leaning posture. We have to regain it.
Military leaders here in Alaska have downplayed concern over last week's incursions by Russian military aircrafts. They note this happens on occasion. It's not a big deal. Do you agree, or how concerned are you about this against the backdrop of the history of these types of flights?
So I would agree that this happens, and it was addressed and responded to properly. I think I would not downplay it perhaps as much, although I understand we don't want to heighten tensions. We don't want to alarm the public. But I think, again, this is part of the education to action part we need. We have to understand this fits into a broader pattern. We also have to make the American people understand that the Arctic is now increasingly contested space. Alaska is really our front line to the Arctic, and we have to see this in a broader context. So while on the one hand, addressing these incursions responsibly, of course, is appropriate, but now we have to start, I think, putting forward a vision, greater security thinking about U.S.'s, our posture in the Arctic. So I hope this is a catalyst for that. I haven't seen it thus far, but again, it gets us from education to action.
Heather, thanks so much for your insights and your time today.
Lori, you're welcome. Thank you so much.